My next guest has been writing for over 30 years and is well known for her very successful works of fiction, which turn modern life dilemmas into gripping stories. She's the author of a number of best-selling novels, including The Rector's Wife, Marrying the Mistress and Daughters-in-Law. And I'm delighted to say that she joins me in studio to talk about her 21st novel, An Unsuitable Match. Joanna Trollope, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
An unsuitable match. We think of perhaps someone like Heathcliff or Mr. Darcy and all of that. This is not quite that kind of thing.
Not at all that kind of thing, because it's set right now and it's a consequence of us all living so much longer.
Because this match is not the first for either of the protagonists.
Certainly not.
Tell me about the two.
Well, the woman has been divorced. Her husband has been, he was a cardiologist, has been carrying on an affair for a very long time, and he's now abandoned her in her late 50s. And the story starts when she is 64 and she meets a man who is now a widower, but whom she had met very briefly as a schoolboy. He's another Englishman, but he's been living in America, and he is 63. And they want to get married. But of course, between them, they have five grown-up children in their 30s now. And those children have very strong views about their parents remarrying.
Now, in the case of the woman, she was bruised by the divorce because she felt cheated upon.
Exactly.
And so on and so forth. So therefore, her daughter does not want mommy to go through that again.
No, she doesn't. But there's something quite pragmatic about it. I went to see a solicitor because I wanted to get all the legal side of a late life marriage, remarriage, right. And this solicitor said to me that only in the last decade, and we're now 2018, so just the last 10 years, she said her firm alone has seen an increase of 33% of people over 65 coming to them saying they want to get married again, and how do they protect their assets?
They want a prenup.
That's what she says to them. She says the only way to protect all this is to have a prenup. And then they say to her, but that's so unromantic.
So they're in their 60s and they want to get married again because romance never dies. But they certainly
sometimes
don't, in case the guy is a chancer.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Suppose, because in this case, the wife has a very nice, a very desirable house.
And what about the widower? I mean, has he any assets to bring to the party at all?
Nothing. And he's hopeless with money. That's why it's unsuitable. And that's what the children are saying to her.
Now, what about his children? Why would they not object to get this fella with nothing off their hands so that in his dotage they don't have to look after him?
Well, there is always that. But I think that the children have had a very bleak childhood, because they've had rather odd parents for various reasons. And so one of them has become obsessed with baking. One of them who is in Seattle, which is did you know, Pat, it is the capital of sourdough bread. And that is a religion. It is not just bread.
I mean, I thought of Starbucks when sourdough bread.
Sourdough bread. It's absolutely a religion. Well, because you need, like vinegar, you need a starter, you need a mother, which needs feeding, and a little bit of it goes into each loaf. So it's something that needs to be, I'm sorry to laugh.
So he has he's too much time dealing with sourdough to be bothered with dad's
exactly.
problems.
Exactly, he's found an obsession. Now, and his sister is an actress, and so she's doing something that takes her out of her own life into someone else's life. So they are really manifesting coping mechanisms for dealing with something that they find really unpalatable, which is their childhood.
Now, how does this widower then offer himself to Rose? I mean, what's he saying recommends him to her?
Well, he's very personable.
A charmer.
He is a charmer, but he's also obsessively in love with her. And that is a very, very hard thing to resist, I think. Looking round at my friends, I would say it's a very hard thing to resist is when a man says to you, I've never felt like this before. And he's in his 60s. And I think that's very, very seductive. And there's a great generation of women, and I don't know whether it's generational or whether it's a type of woman, who feels not quite validated unless there's a man in the mix.
He says, I have never felt like this before.
Yeah.
I love you as much as I could love anything or anybody.
Exactly.
The sun, the moon, the stars.
And I've never really proposed to anybody properly before, but I am desperate to propose to you.
And what about that woman I put in the box there not so long ago? Did I not love her?
No, she proposed to me. And I ended up marrying her. I don't quite know why I did. It just happened, these circumstances. Looking back, I can't quite work it out.
What a treacherous thing to say about his dead
wife. Do you think?
I'm just wondering, does Rose know whether he's telling the truth or not, or whether this is just her assets?
No, he is telling the truth. He is telling the truth. If you were to read the book, you'd understand he was telling the truth.
Yes, well, you wrote him, so you can decide.
I invented
that he's telling the truth.
Exactly. No, he's completely telling the truth. He's an honest, decent, intensely romantic man. And I have to say, Pat, that I think men have a greater capacity to be romantic than women do. I think women are fundamentally a great deal more practical. I think they've had to be.
It's often been remarked to me that men who are widowed inevitably marry again. Women who are widowed say, I'll go out and play cards or go dancing with my friends.
Precisely. But I think if a man has had even a reasonably good marriage, I think he has a feeling that he'd like to do that again. That's what he knows. That's what's familiar. So that kind of repetition is very necessary.
Now, the business of the second time rounders or even the third time rounders.
Yes.
It's becoming more and more common. The divorce rate in the UK is, I think, three times the divorce rate here. We're newcomers to divorce. And the divorce rate in the UK is still only half that in the US.
It is, but we discovered escaping. We discovered secularity a little before Catholic Ireland did, don't you think?
Yes, indeed.
And I think
Pagan England, used to call you after all.
Precisely. And I think that accounts for a lot of it.
But the number of people who say, I've spent 20 years with this person, that's enough, thank you very much.
Yes, and I don't want to be his nurse. But I think there are some people, and again, I don't know whether it's their individuality. I suspect it is. Who persist in this romantic belief that somehow there is the one. I mean, I don't personally believe that, but I think there are a lot of people.
You've had a few goes.
I have had. I've had two goes.
Yeah.
Two goes, but I've been on my own. I've been unmarried for over 20 years now, so it's a long time. But I wanted to call this book something rather different. You see, Dr. Johnson said once, memorably, he said, marrying again is the triumph of hope over experience. And I wanted to call this book The Triumph of Hope. But it is the publishers who insisted on something, I think, a bit more plodding.
But you don't want your title in itself to be a spoiler?
I don't really want it to be a spoiler. No, I think that's quite right. But there was something quite humorous about the Johnsonian thing. And there is a distinct irony in this book.
Are you very well acquainted with many people who've divorced and had a go again?
Yes. Yes, I am.
And can you tell which of your friends would be likely to say never again in terms of their personality type and those who would say, if it comes along, I'll have a go?
Yes, absolutely. And who cannot understand that I don't want to and are perpetually questioning and just think it's... There's something extraordinary about somebody who doesn't want to get married again and who isn't on the lookout for another man. It's a fascinating topic and everybody's got an opinion on it. And what I'm saying in this book is really, can we talk about this? Can we get the conversation going?
The notion that someone who has been widowed, for example, a female, or who's split up and is now, quote-unquote, back on the market.
Yes.
How are they viewed by other women? Are they seen as predators?
Nervously. Yes. Yes, the girl in Limerick said that she had really had great trouble with women friends because they saw her, because she's a single mother, they saw her as a threat to their marriages and stability. And I remember a period of when I was first on my own where I did think of having, manufacturing some kind of label which said, you cannot imagine how much I do not want Nigel or Robert or whatever he was called. You know, I'm perfectly safe. You're the one I'm interested in. But I think that that again is, you know, I'm always saying in all these novels that really our veneer of civilization and of education and cultivation is wafer thin, veneer thin, and that underneath we are a primitive seething mass of instincts.
So the and biology is just waiting to take over from that veneer of civility.
It is. And I think we're the physiology dictates a lot of how we behave.
The idea of falling head over heels in love, we associate this mad, passionate, romantic love with Romeo and Juliet, who were teenagers.
Yes, they were very young. Juliet, I think, was 13 and Romeo was 16. But I had an Emma Bridgewater mug, a coffee mug, years ago. I don't know what's happened to it in all my house moves. But it said round the rim, it said, true love and high adventure. And I remember listening to John Humphreys, you know, who is the mm-hmm. journalist who does the Today programme on Radio 4 back in England. And he said once, I think in a public place, he said, I am just longing just to have one more go at being in love because I want that heady feeling of taking your hands away from the sides. You know, you're on a kind of cresta run of excitement and emotion. And I want that exhilaration once again.
Exhilaration and obsession and
all that.
Foolishness.
But, you know, when people talk about being madly in love, the emphasis should be on the mad because it is a kind of insanity in a way. And whether you like that, whether you are the kind of person who is seeking that or you're the kind of person who would really rather be in control of things, dictates how you feel about love.
In comparing men and women, you talked about women feeling very insecure about that solo, suddenly available woman being at the dinner party or
yes.
at the drinks or whatever it might be. Is it the same for that solo man? Is he seen
No, not at all.
Why not?
Do you think, are we tiptoeing around that word, that old word, patriarchy again? Are we?
But is it assumed that he wouldn't dare? He wouldn't go after my wife.
No, I don't think he's seen like that. He's seen as an asset. To have a spare man at your dinner table is rather a seductive thing, isn't it?
Hmm.
It's most unjust.
So she is seen as siren. He's
yes.
seen as an avuncular spare.
Well, as you think of the on dit, the kind of cultural significance around stepfathers, they're never seen as wicked. And stepmothers, in fact, in, you know, the cultural history of a stepmother shows far more capacity to bring a family together, to remake a family. Men don't do very much of that.
Yeah. And yet it is the wicked stepmother.
It is the wicked stepmother, and it's most unjust.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking over the years, currently we're talking about the patriarchy and, you know, the Me Too movement and so on. Have you had your problems? I mean, have you had to fight them off?
Well, I am of a generation where I was brought up believing that all women were almost inevitably the second gender, the second sex. I remember when I was about 13 or 14, I was tall then. I was the height I am now when I was 12. And I had braces on my teeth and frizzy hair and spectacles. And I remember being taken aside and told quite seriously that I mustn't parade my bookishness, my desire to be behind the sofa with a book, because men were put off at this prospect of a clever girl. And a clever girl in glasses with braces on her teeth was anathema. And you were somehow supposed to be grateful for male attention. So it's been very exciting for me to see this gradual flowering of we've got a long way to go yet, but of a kind of equality, the beginning of an equality between the sexes. And that's all I think anybody's asking for. Mm.
I could imagine, though, if somebody, you know, tried it on inappropriately with you, that you would dispatch them fairly rapidly.
Yes, yes.
With a word, if not more.
Yes, exactly. Well, you once got a tremendous vocabulary and a tone of voice at one's command now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there'd be no nonsense.
Well,
no, what do you think you're doing with your hand on my knee?
She said loudly. Well, the current book is called An Unsuitable Match. It's published by Mantle. It's out now, priced around €15, and its author, Joanna Trollope. It's always a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much, Pat. Well, ditto. It's absolutely lovely.